Hello, this is episode number 37 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Wednesday, August 6, 2008. I'm your host, Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. On today's show, we're going to be discussing the implications of Friday's controversial ruling by the FCC against Comcast that held that the cable giant had engaged in unreasonable network management practices when it delayed access to BitTorrent, a peer-to-peer software program. Even though BitTorrent and Comcast have already settled their dispute and indeed are now working collaboratively together on solutions to these issues, FCC Chairman Kevin Martin said that action was necessary because others had complained about the practice. Incidentally, this is a topic we've covered previously here on our podcast in episodes number 34 and 35, and all of our authors at TLF have been writing extensively about this week on the blog. On today's show, we'll be focusing in on the implications of the FCC's decisions last Friday for the future and for the future of net neutrality regulation more generally. Joining me for today's discussion are some of our regular contributors at the TLF. First, we'll hear from Jerry Brito of the Mercatus Center. Hi, Jerry.
Hello, Adam.
Hans Haney of the Discovery Institute. Hi, Hans.
Hello, Adam.
Tim Lee of the Cato Institute. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Adam.
James Gattuso of the Heritage Foundation. Hi, James.
Oh, hey, Adam.
And Jim Harper of the Cato Institute. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Adam.
Jerry Brito, let me begin with you. Could you begin by giving us a quick rundown of what happened here? And in doing so, tell us a bit more about under what authority the FCC acted in reaching this decision on Friday.
Well, to really get a good grasp on this, you have to start at the beginning, and that's in August of 2005. And the FCC issued what's been called now the Internet Policy Statement. And at that point in 2005, the FCC was looking at how to regulate DSL. Should it be regulated as a common carrier under Title II, or should it be classified as an information service, which has no regulation? And on that fateful day in August 5, 2005, the FCC issued a rule, an order, basically saying that DSL should be classified as an information service and not be regulated. But then separately, it issued a policy statement in which it held what were four, or sometimes considered five, different policies, which were no discrimination, consumer freedom to choose which applications to use, etc. So, you know, that's the basic framework we've been operating under until June 2007, when the FCC starts an inquiry into net neutrality and broadband industry practices. And in that inquiry, the FCC asks, does it have the authority to enforce the policy statement against a provider for violating any of the policies stated in the policy statement? So to this day, the FCC has not issued any sort of conclusion to that notice of inquiry. So in October of 2007, we had what has been come to known as the Comcast kerfuffle, where, as you said, you know, Comcast meddled with BitTorrent traffic on its network. And all signs point to the fact that Comcast was probably doing this to manage its network, to make sure that everything was running smoothly. But they handled it poorly. Once it was revealed, they sort of first denied it, that they were blocking anything. They actually never really disclosed what they were doing. So they really handled the way that they went about it poorly. And ultimately, they were pressured to stop, as you said. So what happened just now is that Chairman Kevin Martin, who's a Republican chairman of the commission, and the two Democrats on the commission voted to sanction Comcast. They basically ruled on a complaint that was filed by Free Press and Public Knowledge. And the sanctions include actually, we don't know what the sanctions include or what the order is, because although they've adopted this order, it's not available on the website. The FCC, as usual, you can't get what their ruling actually is. But it, you know, prohibits the Comcast from doing the sort of blocking that they did ever again, and it requires them to disclose what it is that they did, and to disclose now what sort of network management they're doing now. And they said that whatever it is that they did back then with BitTorrent is definitely not reasonable network management.
So does the FCC have any real authority here to be enforcing this policy statement that was handed down back in August 2005?
Right. So that's a question. You know, does the FCC have authority to use this policy statement against Comcast? And, I mean, here's the way I look at it. There are three types of decisions that the FCC or any agency like the FCC can issue. Number one, you have legislative rules, right? So these are regulations that you and I know as just simple, you know, regulations. Number two, you have interpretive rules. And number three, you have policy statements. In order to do anything, the FCC and any agency under the Administrative Procedure Act must follow what is known as notice and comment, right? It must publish notice that they are intending to regulate. Then they must take comment from the public, consider those comments, and then issue a regulation, right? So if you're going to have a legislative rule, which is a sort of rule that nobody would dispute can be enforced against somebody, you need to have notice and comment. Now, the APA exempts from notice and comment interpretive rules and policy statements, right? Interpretive rules are basically when you already have a rule on the books that was adopted through proper notice and comment, but yet there's some aspect of it that's tiny that you need to interpret. And so when an agency interprets a rule that already exists, it doesn't need to issue notice and comment. That is not what happened here. What happened here is you have a policy statement, and courts have consistently ruled that policy statements cannot be enforced. They have no force of law. So now, aside from the fact that the policy statement that they're enforcing at the very top has the word policy statement, some folks might argue that, well, in fact, this is not just a policy statement. This has, you know, the force of law.
Right. And, okay, so but still there's a real question here as to whether or not there's authority, and then the question becomes, will Comcast litigate on that fact?
That's right, but there's just no question to me, right? Even though it says policy statement at the top, which sort of settles it for me, there was no notice and comment here. This thing was never published in the Federal Register, which is sort of like the first thing that happens when something becomes a rule, right? And if you look at the statement that Kevin Martin issued on the day that this policy statement was released, you know, he says, let me see if I can find it so I can quote it to you. He says, the policy statement we adopt today lists four principles that are based on this fundamental ability to access a website available to the public. While policy statements do not establish rules, nor are they enforceable documents, today's statement does reflect the core beliefs of each of the members of the commission, etc. So even back then, Martin was clear that this was not an enforceable document. It had no force of law.
Right. Well, good. Let me turn to Hans Haney next and ask him, Hans, if you'd like to comment on what Jerry has to say, feel free. But I also want you to help us place this decision in some broader historical context in terms of the progression of communications regulation. What's the big picture here? Is this a historic moment in communications and broadband law?
Well, Adam, first of all, I'd like to cite an earlier moment that I think offers a lesson for us. And you'll recall, and the others will recall, that back in 1999, there was a movement to guarantee access to the cable platform for competing internet service providers. And of course, this was during the Clinton administration, and the FCC at the time was chaired by William Kennard, a Democrat, and the FCC refused to apply an open access requirement to cable for the benefit of ISPs, Kennard stated, we need an intentional restraint born of humility. Competition and deregulation as our touchstones. The FCC has taken a hands-off deregulatory approach to the broadband market. And the reason they did it continues to be applicable with equal force today. There, and I'm quoting, there is no sign that consumers do not have other avenues to get broadband connections if they don't want to use cable. And it's not clear that the perceived benefits of mandating open access outweigh their apparent economic and technological costs. And that's clearly the situation that we have now. Now, historically, this sort of thing, we've seen it. For example, back during the 1920s, there was a movement to prevent ad-supported radio and instead assign frequencies for nonprofit educational and political broadcasts. Some had a utopian vision for the new media, that it could be used to organize the masses to overthrow their oppressors on Wall Street and other places like that. And we're seeing some of that, some of those aspirations today with the internet. But clearly what we have here, the proper role of government should be to ensure that there are no barriers to investment or regulatory uncertainty. So the private investors will step in and provide the investment capital so that broadband providers can build robust, adequate networks. And unfortunately, what the FCC is doing here, this is born out of petty politics, I would say, because as we can recall, there was a wireless provider not too long ago who refused to assign short codes to the National Abortion Rights Action League. And yet the commission did not feel inclined or compelled to intervene at that point. The wireless provider was allowed to voluntarily change its policy, which is the very same thing that Comcast has already done here. So most of the commission's concerns are already a moot point in any event.
Right. Tim Lee, let me bring you into this at this point. What's your take on this decision? Is this a big deal or not?
Well, I'm actually interested in something Jerry said. You said that that Kevin Martin admitted in 2005 that this policy statement wasn't enforceable. Do you have any sense for what his current argument is? Has he changed his mind about that, or does he have some other way of characterizing it that counteracts what he said in 2005?
Well, again, because we don't have the actual order that they adopted sanctioning Comcast, we really don't know yet. But yeah, it does seem basically that they have changed, or he has changed his mind. And you can see the evolution of this when, like I said, in June of 2007, part of the notice of inquiry, they were asking the question, which to me was just amazing. And I thought at the time, I was giving them the benefit of the doubt, I thought that maybe the reason they were asking the question of whether the policy statement was enforceable was to just make it plainly clear and obvious that it was not. But at that point, you could see sort of the evolution of whether they were looking for some authority to regulate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say, I find Jim Harper's the theory he posted about today that this is essentially an inoculation move by Chairman Martin kind of compelling. I mean, this is going to get challenged, and it's going to be bottled up in the courts for several years. And it seems like the likely result, given how common it is for the FCC to be overruled on these sorts of issues, it seems like at some point in 2010 or 2011, this will get overturned. And assuming if Barack Obama is the next president, a more network neutrality friendly FCC might sort of have its hands tied by the need to fight this case rather than starting over with a clean slate and trying to come up with something that would be more likely to stand up in court.
Well, Tim, since you raised Jim Harper's blog entry today on this point, why don't we ask Jim to talk a little bit about his theory here on that issue and where we might be going next. Harper?
Well, it's important to me to be interesting as much as to be right. So I wanted to turn the theory of behavior. And it's true that usually the best explanation for what happens in Washington is incompetence and not guile. But all the same, I think there's a decent synthesis of what's gone on, a sort of game theoretic look at things, where it well could be that looking down the horizon, Chairman Martin said, okay, there's this storm brewing, there's this legislative effort brewing for net neutrality, and it doesn't look like it'll go away. The politics are bad in terms of the presidential election. I can stave off full-blown network neutrality by injecting a little bit of it, and the weakness of the legal arguments that Jerry points out for this authority play into that. The idea that the FCC could spend years in litigation over this, and the issue could spend years in litigation, freezing up both the regulatory efforts and any legislative efforts. Meanwhile, the legislative advocates, they atrophy, they go on to other issues. The folks in the lobbying community go on to other issues. You've killed off the net neutrality regulation issue for a decade under that theory.
And it should be noted that Jim's theory, even if we assume that this wasn't Kevin Martin's plan, that analysis might still be true. It might be, in some sense, a good thing that this came up, that we have a very weak test case that will take a long time to be resolved and likely go in the right direction, that it could be beneficial even if Kevin Martin is incompetent rather than secretly.
Well, let me bring in James Gattuso here and ask him if he'd like to either A, comment on Jim Harper's theory, or B, just talk to us more broadly about what this decision means politically on the Hill and at the FCC in general. I mean, does this diminish the prospect of legislation or regulation, or does it increase it?
Well, I think Jim's argument has a lot to it. In fact, if you look at the statements that were released by both AT&T and Verizon, you see hints of that strategy in there. Both companies stressed that because of this decision, that there's no need for legislation, that the problem is solved. And of course, Congress will, I think it's clear that Congress will have less incentive to move forward with net neutrality regulation as long as this decision stands. Not because the left thinks that the problem is solved from their point of view or that they don't want more, but frankly, when you look at legislative efforts up till now, in Congress, the push for net neutrality has been a failure. And these decisions certainly don't do anything to increase that pressure, and I think it's clear that that does decrease it marginally. Now, the question I have is, first, how long this litigation will last before the decision could be reversed by the courts. I don't see it going on for 5 years. You could get a court of appeals decision within a year, and any sort of bump back to the commission could trigger Congress to jump in and pass something. There's also a possibility that the FCC could, on its own initiative, solve any APA problem, even while the litigation is going on. They could send a policy statement through notice and comment rulemaking, therefore solving, curing any Administrative Procedures Act problems before a court decision. So there are ways to end run any delay that may have been planned into this decision. Lastly, just real quick, there's a third form where we have to be watching this. It's not just the courts and not just Congress, but it's the presidential election. And I think that's going to be key. You have a split among the candidates. Barack Obama is strongly in favor of net neutrality. John McCain has come out. His advisors have been opposing net neutrality regulation. So I think without taking sides in the presidential election, because I work for a nonpartisan organization, but I think the election will be key in deciding how this regulation goes.
Anybody else want to comment on what the election means or what the future holds in this regard?
No.
Yeah, me neither, because I think both these guys are too much of a wild card. And McCain's been a real maverick on a lot of communications issues in both a good and a bad way in the past. So I'm not really quite sure what the future holds, although it is clear if you look at Obama's tech agenda, item number one deals with these issues and pretty clearly states that this is something that he will be aggressive on, and presumably his FCC will be aggressive on. And certainly if we get a Michael Copps or a Jonathan Adelstein FCC, one would think that this would be something that would be part of an active FCC agenda.
So, Adam, there's two things I want to say. The first is, while I don't buy Jim's theory completely, simply because I apply Occam's razor, and that's sort of attributing too much to Kevin Martin, I do see from James' point of view some evidence to suggest that it might be right. If you look at what Comcast's response has been, it has been pretty anemic. I would expect, or I would have expected, Comcast to come out, blazing, shooting, saying we will not stand for this, we will go to court and fight it, and we haven't seen that at all. Which makes me wonder if maybe they're thinking, well, we'll probably file on the very last day and take our sweet time and drag this thing out. The question I have, though, is what happens, 2 months from now, 6 months from now, when, let's say, Verizon blocks Skype, or there is some other kerfuffle like we saw with Comcast? What happens, right? Does the FCC go through this process again? Because it seems
they're
adopting a case-by-case sort of way of dealing with this, which is sort of a preferable way, but they would just have to compound the mistake they've made that today.
Well, and they would use this presumably as a foundation for whatever they knew next, and that's why I can't believe Harper's thesis. And what, moreover, why is it that groups like Public Knowledge and Free Press are out there singing in the streets praising this decision left and right? I mean, that tells us, I think, that they know this is a decision they will build upon and move forward with. Certainly there could be challenges, but Harper, if you'd like to make a bet with me about whether or not this results in anything over the next 10 years, I'm challenging you here publicly, my friend, to a bet on this. I'm certain that this will lead to more mischief at the FCC within the next couple of years, if not the next couple of months, although elections can slow that process down.
Well, there's also two different questions. One question is whether this decision will lead Congress into more mischief or deflect it. And I think it will, at least in the short term, deflect Congress. But your question is I think more to the point. Will it lead the FCC to engage in more mischief? And I think it's clear that they will, and depending upon the personnel change at that commission.
Yeah, I agree with that, James. And Jerry, I just wanted to point out too that the FCC has lots of different procedures that it can use here. I mean, they can just pick up the phone and call a company and say, "Make this go away. We don't want to hear about this. We want you to solve it." Things happen like that all the time. Or similarly, back in 2005 with Madison River, the phone company that was trying to protect its lucrative access charges from VoIP bypass, and there was just a Commissioner Powell negotiated a consent decree, which actually did involve a $15,000 contribution to the Treasury by Madison River. And so I'm not sure that procedurally this is all that significant in view of the more informal tools that are available to the FCC.
And the other thing to keep in mind, I think, is that the major broadband incumbents will probably be on their best behavior for the next year or so. I mean, when you've got a presidential election going on and then a new administration that's going to be looking for new issues to take up, I would be very surprised if Verizon or AT&T or these other big players did something that would really, help rally supporters of regulation. I would think they would, lay low at least until the middle of next year. And then, once the Obama administration or the McCain administration is focused on other issues, then whatever they want to do, they might do. But I wouldn't see them doing it in the near future.
That assumes that the political people know what the operational people are doing, which didn't seem to be the case in the Comcast situation.
Right, but they would have seen the example of Comcast. I mean, I'm sure the senior leader executives at AT&T and Verizon, had a talk with their technical people and said, these are the sorts of things we need to know about ahead of time.
Let me respond to Adam's invitation for a bet with a very elegant cop out. I don't know how we would determine what level of monkey business has been avoided by Kevin Martin acting within my theory. So I don't know how to formulate that bet. But I do think that the folks, the advocates of net neutrality regulation, feel like they've won the battle but may have lost sight of the war. And I think Tim Lee's forthcoming paper out of Cato on net neutrality regulation will help illustrate that they wouldn't even want to win the war, because when the federal government has a comprehensive control over how the network is managed, the Jenna Bush administration, who knows what would happen to their interests then. So
I'm willing to bet it's going to take as long as it takes for Jenna Bush to get in office before Tim's paper's out from Cato.
Touché, my friend, touché.
It's a great paper. I'm looking forward to it, Tim, but I'm wondering where it's at. But anyway, any other comments, guys?
If I can just add one thing on the litigation,
sure.
We're talking about the question of what happens if the decision is overturned. Remember, there are, I think, of at least three ways you can be overturned with vastly different consequences. You could be overturned just on the notice and comment of procedural flaw, which would be easy to fix. It could be overturned based upon the standards that are applied, which I think would lead Congress to jump in. Or, best of all, it could be overturned on a fundamental basis, perhaps a strike against the concept of ancillary jurisdiction, which would be a big win for markets and for against regulation, and unfortunately probably the least likely outcome.
But those are good points, James, and it's something that we've been writing about in other contexts at the Tech Liberation Front blog, is the fact that the FCC has been slapped on recently in other contexts for trying to stretch its jurisdiction or authority too broadly or to change law too quickly. I've been writing myself about how the Second and Third Circuits have slapped on the agency on the indecency front, where the agency actually has some authority to regulate. And even there, the courts are saying, wait a minute, you've got to justify this. You can't go too far. You can't violate the APA. There needs to be a process and a procedure. It has to be reasoned and rational. In this case, as Jerry pointed out, you don't even have that sort of baseline level of authority really even yet established, right? So it seems like there's a pretty strong case that could be made here that the FCC has overstepped its bounds. Jerry, do you agree with that?
No, absolutely. I don't think there's any question, and I'd be willing to bet anybody that this will get overturned. And to James's point, I think courts always look for the simplest way to overturn something. I don't think they would go as far as reaching ancillary jurisdiction.
Right.
So I'm also kind of skeptical. James, you say that it would be easy to cure the problem by simply, you know, having a notice and comment procedure and adopting the principles. But to this day, we've seen how difficult it's been for net neutrality proponents to get anything like this through, right? I mean, they understand. I mean, this is what they've been trying to do. They understand it, or seem to have understood that the policy statement wasn't enough, that they wanted these things codified, and they haven't been able to do it. So I'm not sure it's so simple to...
And the other thing to keep in mind is that one of the advantages of a policy statement is that they don't really have to flesh out the details of, right, you know, who does this apply to and exactly what lines do they have to cross. Presumably, if they went with a formal notice and comment proceeding, for example, they'd have to deal with the issue that Jim talked about, which is, you know, what about universities? What about, you know, coffee shops with open Wi-Fi connections? You know, they just the process of hashing out all those details that they sort of left vague in the policy statement, I think, would drag the debate down quite a bit.
Right. Great. Any final comments, guys?
No.
Okay. Well, that's going to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this week. I want to thank Jerry, Hans, Tim, James, and Jim for joining me this week. And to read more commentary from the entire Tech Liberation Front gang, please visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you'd like to post a comment about something we said today, you can just go to this episode's website at techliberation.com/podcast and leave your comment there. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend, please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next time, I'm Adam Thier. See you then.